Well, Merry Christmas. Glad that you guys are here. That was amazing, wasn't it? Really good job on that. Glad you could be here to experience that with us. My name's Clay. I'm one of the pastors here, and we're thrilled that you would come out on this Sunday. We would love to meet you. You should know a couple of things about this church if you're new to us. One, it's just full of people that are just like you, which means this. Your story, no matter what your story is safe here. No matter what has happened to you, no matter what you've experienced, whatever questions you have, your story is safe in this place, and we just want you to know that. Before we get rolling into our message where we continue in this series, one thing, we've got a baptism that's coming up next week, and if you're in this service and you would like to be baptized, if you'll meet me after the service over here, we're going to talk a little bit about that, and then we'll experience baptism together. But before we get going, let me kind of start our service off with prayer here. Jesus, welcome into this place. We have sang so many great songs about your name, your fame, all that you are and what you have done for us. And so we sit now and we welcome your Holy Spirit in, and we just ask that you would speak to all of us in very individual ways, no matter what we've gone through, no matter what we've come through. God, speak to us in this time. We pray it in the name of Jesus. Amen. Well, we're in part two of a series that we've been calling The Light Has Come. And last week, we kind of began with the story of the wise men and the magi. And there was a great bit of good news that came from that story. And it was probably good news for many of us in this room. It was simply this, that no matter what your story is, that God cares more about how open your heart is than he does about how well you have followed the rules. That he's really looking at how open your heart is, and it doesn't matter what your past is, it doesn't matter what is going on, that God can use you. And so we're going to continue this week, and we're going to talk about some more characters, and then next week we're going to talk about another character that plays a role in the story of Jesus. But this week, before we get into that, I have a very specific agenda that I kind of have laid out, and God's laid out in front of me, that I would like to be able to accomplish. And sometimes when my agenda is so specific, I want to be upfront about it so it doesn't feel like a bait and switch as we go. And basically, my agenda is this. If you're here in this space listening in the room or listening to our podcast or watching online, maybe you had a faith experience, and it was maybe it was when you were a kid, or maybe it was a couple of years ago, or it was 10 years ago, or 20 years ago, or 30 years ago. If you've ever had an experience where you have prayed a prayer that said something like, Jesus, come into my heart, I want to make you the leader of my life, or however it is that you did it, and you began a relationship with God through Jesus, if that was your story, but for some reason, whatever your reasons are, you kind of just left it from there, or you've wandered away, or it just became part of your past experience, and you could have wandered away for a variety of reasons, and you know, we could talk about all of those reasons, and there were good reasons. Maybe you wandered away because you had this experience, and it was as a kid or as a teenager, and then your parents moved, and just for whatever reason, you just never went back to a church, and so you know, it's just kind of laid dormant there. Maybe you're like many people, and you had a bad church experience. I think all of us in here have had a bad church experience, or 10, or 20, or 100. Right, and so you had a really bad church experience. You said, you know what, I just don't want to deal with it. Or maybe you went to college and you had some sort of philosophy class and they began to talk about some things or whatever the case was, and you just quit believing. And so if you're not believing, then you know it's not genuine, so you're just not going to go to a church. Or maybe it just wasn't part of your routine, you know, just never established, and so you just kind of quit being a part of a church. Or maybe some tragedy happened. And I mean, it was a really big thing, and you prayed and prayed and prayed, and God never answered your prayer. And so your thought was, God, if you're not interested in that level of pain in my life, if you're not going to come through at that level of pain, then you know what? I just don't want anything to do with you. And so, I mean, that caused you to walk away from your faith. Or maybe someone told you something about the Bible and it contradicted with something that you learned, and therefore you turned away. I don't know what the reason is that you wandered away, because I don't know your story, but here's what I know about your story. If my story was your story, or your story was my story, and the life played out the way it has for you, I would probably have made the same choices and done many of the same things that you've done, because the choices that we make and the path that we take, they make sense to us in the moment. We just don't do things that don't make sense. And I'm sure if you told me what your story was, I would look at that and I go, yeah, I could see how you got to where it is that you have gotten to, and it makes perfect sense. So my agenda and what I want to do for the next few minutes is talk to you. And if that's your experience where faith really hasn't, at one point it was a part of your life and maybe you wandered away, or maybe even now you're considering faith. But my agenda is, if that is your experience, I would really like you, by the time we get to the end of this message, to at least consider re-engaging with faith. I just want you to take whatever baby steps that you need to and just consider the possibility that you might re-engage with faith. And that's going to look different for every person in this room. Maybe for you, the next step for you to re-engage in your faith would be, I'm just going to start going to church again. So that means I'm going to show up again next week, and maybe that's your step. Maybe your next step as you begin to re-engage with the faith that you once had is to pray a prayer. And it's probably been a long time since you prayed a prayer, and it's okay. You can pray a prayer similar to like it says, hey, God, it's me. Been a while since we talked. That's okay. I mean, you can, honestly, you can start a prayer that way. Or maybe for some of us in the room, your next step is you've had a friend or a neighbor or a coworker, and they've been inviting you to some sort of study or a group or something, and maybe it was they invited you here, and they want you to be in their life group. Like, I don't even know what a life group is, and whatever. They've invited you. Maybe your next step is, you know what? I'm just going to go to that group. You know, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to show up, and maybe that is your next step. I don't know what re-engaging for you means, but I do know that this is the perfect time as we begin to talk about Christmas and the Christmas message for you to re-engage. And here's why I want to encourage you to do that, because here's something that I know about you. And the reason that I know it about you is because it was also true about me, that somewhere in your head, deep in your soul, in your heart, in the inner side of you, you know, that part of you that is just you, there is still a little bit of light. There's a spark. There's an ember that is still there. And every once in a while, it dings your conscience. Every once in a while, you have this thought and this conversation with yourself where you say, I ought to. And then you get busy and you don't think about it again. And then all of a sudden it shows back up and you have this thought and there it is again. I ought to. And then you think about all the reasons that you quit doing it in the first place. And I don't want to do that. And then you stop. But there's just something that's there, and it's always continually there. And every once in a while, someone will say something, or you sit inside of a message like this. And many of you are going to have this moment. You're like, how did he know about my life? How did he know what this is? Because all of us, we have these experiences where this thing, this conscience just comes and says, you know what, you ought to, you ought to, you ought to, and you should reconsider. And every once in a while, it just rises up in you, and something he says, you should reconsider. You should reconsider getting engaged. You should get all your questions answered. You should think about going back to church. You should really get engaged in this. You should read this. There's just this still, small voice inside of you. And we believe, And you used to believe at one point, and I believe at some point, I hope, my hope for you is that you believe again. We believe that voice that is inside of you that continues calling and drawing you back is the light of Jesus that is in your life. The Bible says that he stands at the door and he just continually knocks and he's there, and it's just this light. And at one point you were engaged and he never left. And he's continually saying, hey, here's what you should do, here's what you should do. And so, guys, I just really want you, as a part of this message, to just consider, would you consider re-engaging with the faith that you once had? And to do that, I want to leverage the story of the birth of Jesus. And I really want to talk about one of the characters that is in the story. Now, if we were to sit and I were to ask you a very odd question, who do you identify most with in the story, in the Christmas story, in the story of Jesus? And if you were to think about it, you went through all the characters, I mean, you could start, you would say, well, Mary. No, I don't identify with Mary. You know, I can't. Joseph, do you identify with Joseph? I don't know much about the dude, so I don't know. I can't engage with him. Shepherds, well, I mean, they're just a bunch of scaredy cats and afraid. The Magi, I don't know. Bunch of wealthy guys. I don't know that I can really get on that. And then there's baby Jesus. No, can't. I can't really identify that great with baby Jesus. But let me tell you about one character that I identify with. And I believe most of us can identify with him, and generally, he is the character most thought about as the villain in the story of Jesus, and his name is Herod. And quite honestly, I think there is a little bit of King Herod in all of us. Now, let me talk a little bit about who King Herod is and how he came to be. King Herod is what we would call a puppet king for the Roman Empire. So the Roman Empire, they'd come in, they would take over an area, and then they would appoint someone to be king. And they would say, you can rule over this, but you need to do what we say. And so Rome came in, they took over the Middle East region, they took over Judea, where Israel is, and they and they said, here is your king. And they put Herod as king. And Herod is king of the Jews. And here's the irony. He's not even Jewish, which really aggravates the Jews, that their king is not even Jewish. But here he is. He is the ruler over the people that is there. He is named Herod. One of the nicknames is Herod the Great, sometimes called Herod the Builder. He built many things. He built port cities. He built aqueducts. He rebuilt the temple. He was just a massive builder, very, very, very smart, very, very politically astute, was just well-connected, knew what to be able to do, and very, you know, quite honestly, self-serving. He did all of these things in order to better himself. And there was no project that was too big for Herod. One of the palaces that he wanted to have, it was a summer palace that he wanted to be built. It was in a specific region of Judah, and he wanted to build a palace. You're like, okay, well, you're a king. But he wanted the palace to be on a mountain. The problem was, there was no mountain. So guess what he did? He built a mountain so he could put his palace on it. I mean, this is the level that the man was at. Whatever he said, whatever he wanted, whatever ambitions he had, he could accomplish. This is Herod the Great. Now, before we get to the Bible part of him, let me tell you an interesting story. It will kind of set up the mood and give you a little bit of history behind the Bible part of what we're doing. In the year 44 BC, so in the year before Herod, before Jesus was born, in 44 BC, there was a Roman emperor. You may have heard of him. His name was Julius Caesar, right? He made an incredible salad. He was an amazing guy. And so Julius Caesar in the year 44 BC was murdered. If you remember back to your maybe high school or college history days, he's murdered. You remember the phrase, et tu, Brutus, right? He's betrayed by his friend. Brutus murders him, kills him. Well, what happens during this time is his nephew named Octavius and another man that was loyal to Julius Caesar named Mark Antony, they kind of come together. Now, Octavius later becomes Caesar Augustus. We can go ahead and put their names up here so we're a little bit of a reference. So Mark Antony and Caesar Augustus, just known as Octavius at this point, decide they're going to avenge the death of Julius Caesar. And so they go on a rampage and they start hunting down anyone that had anything to do with the kingdom or anything to do with the rebellion, and they killed them all. Okay? They wiped them out. So what is left when we come to the end of this is, okay, there's no opposition. Now there's two leaders. Who's going to lead Rome? Is it going to be Mark Antony or is it going to be Octavius? Now, the people in the Roman Empire, they did not like Mark Antony because of his wife. Mark Antony had a very famous wife. Anyone know his wife's name? Like one person in the back. Cleopatra. Very, very good. Go back, do your history. So Cleopatra is his wife, and Rome doesn't like her because they're like, she's going to impose her beliefs and her systems on top of us, so we don't want Mark Antony. But yet, there were still people loyal to him, and there is this civil war that begins to rise up. People that are supporting Mark Antony and people that are supporting Octavius. Now, Herod, where he comes into the picture, Herod decides that he is going to throw all of his support behind Mark Antony. So he begins to host dinners, and he has Cleopatra in, he has Mark Antony in, and he would raise support. He showed up at the rebellion at Alexandria in support of Mark Antony. He was a loyal supporter, believing this is the guy who's going to take over the Roman Empire, I'm going to get behind this. But eventually, there's a war that takes place between Mark Antony and Octavius wins in short order. It's not even a contest. And Mark Antony is pushed back into Egypt. And now you're left with one ruler who declares himself Caesar and names himself Caesar Augustus. And here is Herod, who bet all his money on Mark Antony, who has now lost. And he has three options at this point during this time. He could go ahead and just kill himself, which a lot of people would do. He could wait for them to come get him, which they are going to do. Or he can run and hide, of which they're going to find him and then kill him. None of his options are good. He bet on the wrong person. He's a loser. But he is so politically astute. He makes one of the smartest political moves in history. He decides to show up in front of Caesar Augustus. So he goes to the island of Rhodes, where Caesar Augustus is. He declares himself at the doors of the place where he's at. This is King Herod. I've come to see Caesar Augustus. They're looking at him like he's crazy. You're an enemy of the state. We're going to hunt you down. You saved us a favor to come get you. We'll just kill you here on the spot. But yet Caesar says, bring him in. I will listen to him. And when he has an audience with the emperor, he says this. He says, look, here's something that you know about me, O great Caesar. I was loyal to Mark Antony. Yes, I was loyal in the beginning. I was loyal all the way through the civil wars. I was loyal in the end. Here's what you need to know about me. My loyalty will last forever. And so, Caesar, I pledge my loyalty to you. And Augustus was taken aback by this. And instead of removing his kingdom, instead of killing him on the spot, he actually sends him back and gives him three other territories that he is now king over. He expanded his kingdom. Again, very smart, very astute guy. And when he comes back, now his power is even more consolidated and he becomes even more ruthless because he will do whatever he can to maintain control of the situation. If you ever went against King Herod, you died. Anyone that upset him was killed. Anyone that opposed him was wiped out. He maintained order. He maintained systems. This is how he operated. Many of the rabbis that were in the region would oppose him. And when he found out that they would oppose him, he just had them killed. So if you were a Jewish rabbi, you avoided being anywhere near the king. I don't want to be near the king because bad things happen when you say things that he does not like. This is King Herod, maintaining power, very smart, politically astute person as he comes in. Now, when we get to the biblical narrative, Herod is about 70 years old. He's an older man, and he has a very, very, very painful kidney disease, one that will kill him. He spends most of his life in pain at this point. And at the point when Jesus is born, he's trying to consolidate his power. He's trying to extend his rule and his reign to make sure that it goes on forever. And now his mind changes continually. Interesting things about him, he has 10 wives. He has a couple of them killed, and then he would have a son. And a couple of times he tried to, this is the son who's going to be king. And then they would do something he didn't like, and he'd have them killed. And then he'd promote the next son. And they would do something he doesn't like, and he'd have them killed. Eventually, I think the son said, it's good, Dad, I don't want to be king. But at this point, he's trying to consolidate his kingdom. He's trying to figure out who's going to rule, what is going to be able to happen. He knows that the end is coming, and then he gets the most disturbing news imaginable, that 5 miles south, there's a ruckus that's going on. And so Matthew, into this narrative, he begins to write for us the Christmas story. Matthew chapter 2, he says, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked. Now imagine with me, they are now coming a long distance. They've walked into the capital city where King Herod is at, and they are asking the question, hey, where's this new king that's been born? Where's this new king? They're like standing in the street. Hey, where's the new king? And people are going, shh. Herod's not dead yet. Like a Monty Python movie. I'm not dead yet. Like, he's not dead. Where's the king? Where's the king? Like, whoa, shh. Right? And so Herod hears this. Like, what are these guys asking? So they say, where's the one who's been born the king of the Jews? We saw his star rose and we've come to worship him. When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed. And all Jerusalem with him. Now that you understand the context of King Herod, you can understand when the king is disturbed, the whole city's upset. Like, oh no, who's going to die? What's going to happen? This is not going to be good because when the king is upset, he is likely to do just about anything, right? So then the text goes on. When he had called together all of the people's chief priests and teachers, so he brings all the religious leaders in. Could you imagine? He's calling for them to come into his throne room again. And they're like, dude, this is not good. Like, it didn't work out so well for Simeon last time that he came, right? He's calling them all together. They're nervous. They're anxious. They don't want to say anything that he doesn't want to hear. But he calls them together and he asks them where the Messiah was to be born. In Bethlehem, Judea, they replied. For this is what the prophet had written. It's almost like if you were Jewish, you would know where he's supposed to be born. So they begin to say something that I'm sure they did not want to say because they know it's going to upset him. But they say, but you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people. And this is like the worst news imaginable that they could deliver. So the story continues, verse 7. Then Herod called the Magi secretly, and he found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and search carefully for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I can go and worship him." Verse 9, after they had heard the king, they went on their way. And the star they had seen when it rose went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshiped him. And that word worship there, we've kind of, in our Western culture, we've made worship synonymous with singing. And while singing is a part of worship, worship is not singing. It's so many more things. Let me explain to you what true worship is and why they would do this. Worship is coming into the presence of someone that you should be in awe of, and someone that just is so much greater than you and so much bigger than you. You're so in awe that you take a position physically, mentally, maybe you bow down, whatever, that you just lower yourself. You're so in awe. That is what worship is. And this is what the Magi do. So they are sitting bowed down in awe of this baby king. And then 5 miles to the north, there's Herod. Herod is sitting and waiting. Where are the Magi? Have you seen them yet? Have you seen them yet? And they're supposed to come tell me where this kid is, because we're going to take this kid out. They're supposed to tell me where this supposed king is. Have you seen him? Post someone on the road and tell me where, when they're coming. I want to know right away. And he's just wringing his hands, just waiting and waiting in anticipation. You see, he is worried that he's going to lose control. Everything that he has worked for, he is worried that it is about to be taken away. He has spent his entire life building around preserve, protect, control. Preserve, protect, control. Every situation, I'm going to preserve, protect, control. And now there's this thing, this baby, this king. How can a king be born? He's going to take everything away from me, and he's racked with pain. His fist is clenched, and he's like, I'm going to take care of this, and no way am I going to bow down, and no way am I going to worship another king. I'm not going to release the control of my life to this other thing. He's not about to worship. And when I say that there's a little Herod in all of us, what I think, what I find in myself, and you probably find in yourself, is that I don't mind leveraging God. I don't mind leveraging my experience with God if there's some way that God is going to help me build my kingdom. That if God is going to help me, then I'm okay coming to church every single week. If God's going to help me build my kingdom, then I'm okay praying. If God is going to help me build my kingdom, then I'm okay reading my Bible. But if God is not going to work for me, I don't know that I'm going to work for him. What I have a problem with and I struggle with, and maybe you struggle with, is this whole idea of my life is a blank check. There's a little bit of Herod in all of us that says, you know what, God, I'm okay to kind of give you a little bit, but I don't know that I'm going to give you my whole life. I don't know that I'm going to come in and worship you and say, look, I'm all yours and I'm completely surrendered to you. I just have trouble with that. This whole idea that the answer is yes, and now what's the question? I don't know that I can go there. Like, it's still about me and what I need and what I want. And I find that, and I battle that even in my life, and I'm sure you battle it in yours. There's a little bit of Herod in all of us. And so the story continues. Verse 12. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they, being the wise men, they returned to their country by another route. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up," he said. "Take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night, and left for Egypt. And if this were a movie, you could feel the dramatic music just beginning to build. Like, uh-oh, like something is going to happen. The story goes on. Verse 16, when Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious. He was furious. And when Herod was furious, people suffered. When Herod was furious, people died. Because he had spent his whole life getting everything that he'd want, and you do not defy him, you do not make him angry, and when you do, you pay the price. Men, especially in this room, we can spend our whole lives trying to control things. We spend our whole lives trying to control the situation at work and trying to manage this, and then we come home and we try to control the situation to manage the outcomes there. This is no different than Herod. He spent his whole life, no matter what the situation was, no matter what it was, I'm going to manage this, I'm going to control this. Even when he backed the wrong person for the emperor of Rome, he still says, I'm smart enough to think of a way out, and I'm going to control the situation, and he was successful. He thinks, I can control all things. I've got this. I'm going to control all the outcomes. And when he figured out that he had been outsmarted and outwitted by a bunch of foreigners and a little baby, he was livid. He was furious, and he had decided that no matter what happened, I am not going to be thwarted. This plan is not going to change. I'm still going to get what I want. And he gives an order that we can't even imagine giving. And soldiers execute an order that we can't imagine having to go out and execute on. He says, look, if you're not going to bring me the one, if you're not going to bring me this kid, if you're not going to tell me where he is so that I can take care of this one, I'm going to push the nuclear option. And this is what he did. Text says, and he gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and his vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. And this is what the soldiers did. On one terrible morning, on one horrible afternoon, and one just tremendously horrendous evening, soldiers come pouring into the town of Bethlehem and the outlying regions. And they go into every home, they go into every inn, they go into every hobble, every space where someone could take up occupancy, and they are looking for a child. And if you had a child that was a boy that looked like he was in the range that Herod had said, on the spot, they murdered them. And if you tried to stand against them as a family member, they killed you too. And then Mary, who flees to Egypt, you've got to imagine she gets word of this, that she had probably had friends and people that she knew, that their child had been killed while Herod was searching for her son. And soon after this, maybe possibly in fact even within the year of this happening, Herod finally dies. Now again, he dies a very painful death. The end of his life, we're told it was so painful to him that he tried to commit suicide. And committed suicide during this time was not a very easy thing. There was no pills to take. It was a very ugly, painful way to go. And we find from other sources he tried to kill himself, but his cousin had stopped it. So he continued living out in pain until the day that he died. And right before he died, he told all of his soldiers, he said, I want you to go out and I want you to round up all of the noblemen in the whole city of Jerusalem. Go get everybody that's important, everybody that's well thought of, and I want you to take all these men and I want you to put them in prison. And so they did, and they rounded them up. And this is the order that he gave. He said, on the day that I die, I want you to kill them all. Because he knew when he died, no one was going to mourn his death. In fact, they were probably going to throw a party. So what he said is, when I die, I want you to kill everybody that everybody likes, so at least there will be mourning on the day that I die. This is the guy of who he was. So Herod dies, and they don't follow through with that order. They let them all go. This is the Herod that we're talking about. And can you imagine, you know, if you were able to sit with Herod? Well, let's back up. Let's go to verse 20. So Herod dies. His angel comes and appears to Joseph. Then in verse 20, it says, get up, take the child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel, for those who you are trying to take the child's life are dead. And in this really strange twist of history, God takes Herod's story, this great man who had built great things, and Herod the Great, and accomplished great things, and had just established his power and his authority. God takes this great man, and he turns him into a footnote in the story of the baby Jesus. Could you imagine having a conversation with Herod and saying, Herod, I've got some good news and some bad news. The good news is, 2,000 years from now, people are going to be talking about you. People are going to, you know, talk about your name. They're going to tell your story. And they're going to say it in languages that haven't even been invented yet. Your name is going to be spoken in places that haven't even been discovered yet. You can imagine Herod going, yeah, this is awesome, this is amazing. I said, well, that's the good news. The bad news is they're not going to talk about the buildings that you built. They're not going to talk about all the great accomplishments that you get. They're not really going to call you Herod the Great. You're going to be known as Herod the Butcher. You're going to be known for the evil things that you did. And your story is just going to be mentioned in a blip in the life of this baby that you tried to kill. He couldn't even comprehend what is going on. And then, 80 years after this, there's an apostle, his name is John. So you got Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. John is the disciple that Jesus spent a lot of time with, probably spent the most time with. John is the one that when Jesus died on the cross, that Jesus said, look, I want you to take Mary, my mom, and take her as your own. So 80 years later, John, this guy who has spent time with Jesus, saw everything that Jesus did, and spent time with his mom. Could you imagine at some point all the questions like, tell me about the morning that Jesus was born. Tell me about what it was like. Tell me when you fled to Egypt and how you got away. Tell me that story again. Tell me what it was like when you learned that Herod had killed all these babies trying to find your son. And he had been told these stories over and over and over. And then 80 years later, John finds himself sent to this island to be isolated. It was this punishment. You are now exiled to this island. He's sitting in loneliness. He's watched Christ come. Christ has died. He has resurrected. All of his friends have been executed and killed for the faith. The Roman Empire is still there. Augustus has come and gone. Nero has come and gone. Tiberius has come and gone. There are emperors that have come and gone, but the empire is still there. In the face of all that he's seen, in the face of all of the tragedy, he's sitting on this island and he thinks, I should write down this story though. I need to write down the story of Jesus. And so he pens for us the story of Jesus in John chapter 1. In thinking about all that he has seen and all that he has lived out, this is how John writes. He says in John chapter 1, in him, this baby that was born, that grew to be a man, this man that was his friend, in him was, past tense, it was, in him was life, and that life was, again, past tense, that life was the light of all mankind. And as he's writing it, he's thinking, yeah, we thought it was all for Jews. It was just a Jewish faith and it was all about us. But now I get it. Now that I see as the gospel has gone out, it's not just for Jews. It is for everyone. The light is the light of all mankind. The light, he begins to write. And I think he pauses and he reflects. And he shifts tense from past tense. And he says, now I've been writing about what was. I want to write to people that are going to read this thousands of years later about what is going on right now, how things are right now. And he says, the light shines. Not shined, shines. Right now, the light shines in the darkness. Again, he had been exiled to the Isle of Patmos. It looks like the Romans had won. All his friends are dead. He's sitting in isolation. The Jewish temple has been destroyed, never to be rebuilt. And he says, the light shines in the darkness. And then he writes this phrase for us. And the darkness has not overcome it. Darkness hasn't blown it out. Yeah, it looks like it looks like Rome has won. It looks like that there's a cause for loss. But I am here to tell you that the light has not been overcome by darkness. So the question, when we come to this, is a really simple one. What will your story be? What will your story be? You see, when you get to the end of your life, someone's going to tell your story. And what is your story as it relates to this light of life? Is it going to be a story of resistance? Is it going to be the story like King Herod where I'm just going to resist everything and I'm going to push back against and no, it's my kingdom and it's all about me and I'm going to control and I'm going to control all these things. And yeah, at one point in my life, yeah, I accepted Jesus, but you know, I just want to kind of go my own way and do my own path and I just want to resist. Or is it going to be a story of worship? Is it going to be like the Magi that just say, look, here we are in the presence of one that we can't understand or comprehend and we just bow down? And we say, yeah, whatever, God, whatever you want with my life, whatever your question is, the answer is yes. You see, one day someone's going to tell your story. And the good news is this. You get to choose what story it is that they tell. So your story can be, yeah, I prayed some prayer and I began a relationship with God, but you know, I kind of went on my own way and I did my own thing and I kind of started my own life and it just never really worked out, but I was just too proud or too, I just could never come back to God. I mean, that could be the story that you tell. Darkness overtook me. Or the story that you could tell could be the one that John says. That there was darkness, but the darkness did not overcome the light. Yeah, I once accepted Christ. Yeah, I went that way. And there was a period of my life where, you know, I went my own direction. Maybe a whole season of my life where I did my own thing. But I came and I returned. And Jesus was just knocking and knocking and knocking. And I just decided I'm going to open the door. And it's not going to be about me and it's not going to be about my way. And from this day forward, and from whatever it is, for the rest of my life, I just began to say yes to God. Whatever you want, yes to God, yes to God. And that could be a story that people tell about you. You get to choose. And so, like I said from the very beginning, my agenda is just for you to consider. Would you consider re-engaging with the faith that you once had? It could be as simple as coming back next week. You could get in a group. You could begin praying. I don't know what your next step is. I just plead with you that you would hear John who says, look, I know it's dark. I know it seems dark, but here's the good news. The light has not been overcome by the darkness. Would you just reconsider coming to the light of Jesus? Let's all pray together. Jesus, we thank you that what is born out in truth of us is that the darkness cannot overwhelm us. That the darkness cannot blow out the light that is in our life. And God, I imagine all across the room, there are those of us that are saying, yeah, I need to consider or I need to reconsider faith in Jesus. God, I pray that you would give us the courage to do that. God, if it's to keep coming to church, then God, just give us the strength to keep doing that. If it's to show up at some group, at some work thing or neighborhood thing or group that this church has, God, give me the courage to take that step. If it's to just begin praying to you on a consistent basis, God, give me the courage and the strength to do that. Lord, whatever it is, God, I pray that your light would shine bright. And I declare, as John declares, that the darkness will not overcome it. God, no matter where we're at, I pray across this space in this room, we engage with the idea that you are the light of the world. You are the hope of the world. And I'm going to put my faith, my hope, my beliefs, everything that I am, God, I'm going to go all in on that. God, I pray that for all of us in this space. I pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.